Good morning, everyone. I'd like to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much for being here. What we're going to do is we have a number of public hearings and work sessions scheduled for today. We are going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 690. I have Senator Frederick and I think Representative Parrish here. And so we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on 690.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 690 allows a person convicted of a felony or a Class A misdemeanor to obtain a certificate of good standing. Requirements include compliance with the sentence and completion of any required treatment or educational programs. Directs the court to notify state police for purposes of entry into the law enforcement data system and the National Crime Information Center. Requires the court to revoke certificate and notify state police for purposes of removing from data systems under specified circumstances. Prohibits district attorney from conditioning plea offer on future eligibility for a certificate and provides a rebuttable presumption of non-negligence to employer who hires employee with certificate of good standing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lou Frederick, Senator from District 22, North and Northeast Portland. You've seen a theme through this whole process, especially coming out of our task force. I'm going to read a little bit of one of the paragraphs from the task force report that I think is appropriate. And it says, individuals with criminal records face some of the greatest impediments to success. They are a population that society continues to punish well beyond and well after the imposition and completion of a sentence that was supposed to pay their debt to society. The slate is supposed to be clean, especially for those who take responsibility for their actions, pay the price society demands, and strive to rehabilitate and repair wrongs. They are a population that is worthy of a second chance based on principle alone, the same principle that permeates our criminal justice system, fairness. That's what we're talking about within this situation, within this particular bill. In particular, we're talking about certificates of good standing. And those are really simply understood. It has to have been a year since a person completed all the terms and conditions of a criminal sentence. No new charges are pending. The person either has a lawful source of support or is engaged in seeking employment, training, education, or participation in other programs. And this is the basic aspect. I encourage you to take a look at section eight of the bill itself, and you will see that it is very simple. It is a simple approach to try to make sure that we get people not only out of prison but moving along well, so that we have people who are encouraged and enjoying and participating in our society. That's the basic idea behind this bill.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin, and really pleased to be a sponsor on this bill for Senate Bill 690, and just continue to be excited about the work that's coming out of this task force and the important need for it. You know, I read an article the other day, and I was really actually quite surprised. It was an article about Tim Allen. He's a comedic actor, and it talked about the fact that he had committed a felony and spent 2 years in prison. And I would have never thought that, right? He's a good citizen, upstanding, makes people laugh. People have things in their past. And sometimes people get a way out, and not all of us become multi-million dollar actors. But you know, sometimes people need a way out. And this is about doing that. It's kind of like a good housekeeping seal of approval with the state of Oregon seal on it, right? Our state seal means something. So when a court issues a document that says certificate of good standing from Clackamas County Court or from Marion County Court, and somebody who's come out of our prison system and who's done their time, we should have forgiveness in the law. And at some point, if we want to help people along and get them out of the revolving door of our prison system, this is an easy, very low-cost way to do this, where someone would be able to take one of these certificates to a landlord and say, look, the state of Oregon, the court of whatever county they live in, trusts me to do the right thing now from here on in. That they can take that to an employer. And the employer can trust that we have put our faith in this individual and said they're good to go back to work. They've solved their problems. They've got whatever issue that put them in jail or put them in our prison system. They got that under the control. and we need to give them a chance. And so this is about some surety for employers and for landlords. It's about a source of pride for somebody coming out of the justice system and say, you know what, I did do what I needed to do. I met all the obligations of my parole and probation, and I am a viable member of society. I think there's an intrinsic motivation for somebody who gets one of these. And so I would urge you to pass this, and let's give folks a way and a path to get their lives back on track, because we do see people who may be screwed up once, but that doesn't mean they don't have worth. That doesn't mean they can't go on to a future career or a, you know, a life of, in Tim Allen's case, entertaining us, you know, and take that experience and turn it into something really positive. We know that we continue to have a recidivism rate that's unacceptable. And a lot of times it's because people can't find a job, because they can't get housing. It's just going to be easier for me to steal your wallet and steal your ID and take somebody else's life because it's too hard to get mine back. And I think for a lot of the people who are incarcerated or felons that I speak with, in some of the work that I do when we're not in the building, that's a real thing for them. I have had people tell me, you know, it would just be easier for me to commit one more crime so I can get my life back together, because they think that that's going to be the tool, because that's the easier path to get there. So let's give them a way that's an honest path, the certificate, and give them one more tool to get out of the circumstances that put them in prison in the first place.
All right. Thank you. Senator Denborough, you want to make
a
comment?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My colleagues have spoken very eloquently about why this is such an important program. This was one of those concepts that we got more and more excited about throughout the course of the task force. And what we discovered was that Justice Paul DeMunez had a concept about certificates of good standing that in the 2015 session he had put forward. It was in the House. It never got out of the House never got out of committee. So I didn't know about it. I think many of us didn't know about it. But we started working with him, and that is the core of the bill that's before you. However, we've done a lot of work with this, and we have generated amendments that are in process. We don't have them yet. To make this a more simplified process for people who are formerly incarcerated. We should have those amendments anytime. If there are questions that come up, I'd be happy to talk about how to make this process more streamlined, both for the system, but also for the individual, and to make sure that everybody that needs to sign off will sign off. I just want to say that you know, when we passed the Ban the Box legislation, we gave people with records the opportunity to have an interview. But what they need beyond that is the kind of certificate that Representative Parrish described, something that they can take with them to show that they are worth the investment. They're worth a chance being taken on them. They've earned it. They deserve it. They're different people than they were when they were inside. And this certificate is set up to certify that. And I will say that, you know, one of the questions that came up was, why not just go for expungement? And there are a number of reasons for that. But one that I would put forth is, you know, it's as Rep. Parrish mentioned, people have things in their past. And there's a notion that if you get your record expunged, those things are no longer in your past. But we know that in the age of the Internet, nothing ever disappears. And so this is an attempt to have a proactive document to show that, you know, no matter, you know, what you find on the Internet, this is certification from the courts, from the state of Oregon, that I am someone who, you know, would be a good tenant or a good employee for you.
Any questions? Senator Thatcher first.
Thank you. You know, the first thing I thought of was good housekeeping seal of approval when I saw that, because I had never heard of the particular certificate of good standing. It's like, what the heck is this? It's very creative. It's kind of an interesting idea. I like the concept. I'm wondering, is there a way, I don't know if these have been used anywhere else or what, but my question is, would an employer or a landlord be able to actually check and make sure that this is an actual real certificate of good standing and not that it's a reformed forger that is good at forging? I don't know.
Senator Thatcher, the bill talks a little bit about, I don't know that there's necessarily a database that you go look, but the bill does talk about that it would be a violation if you presented a revoked or an invalid or false certificate and somebody later found out about that or you're, so I don't know,
ask a clarification. It would seem to me if this is being issued by the court, it seems like it would be filed with the court, right. It seems like
public
it would
record.
Be a record within the court system.
Public record.
Yeah.
So exactly. As long as it's doing that, then they would be able to do a cross check.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, I mean, I think, again, you know, Senator Thatcher, to me, this is, it's an incentive. I'm sort of a carrot person than a stick person. I think it's an incentive for people to want to go get one.
Representative,
yes.
I appreciate going in more detail. We have a lot of people on the
sure.
get on
right.
the testifying. We understand that everyone's supporting it. I just want to take questions that we
okay.
have as to now and let the other advocates come forward. Senator Lithicum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about the actual definition, what this is comprised of in this document, the 487 as we have it, and I hear there are amendments going to be constructed, but these things, if someone is met standards for our state standards, 3 years, for recidivism, et cetera, it sounds like, ding, they get a certificate. And I'm wondering if that's all you're looking for, are there other items that are in the definition of what this certificate represents? What does it look like? How does one go about getting it? The idea sounds fabulous. I don't see, at a technical level how it comes about. So what are your ideas?
Well, there's quite a process, actually, and Chair and members of the committee, there's quite a process, and that's part of the amendment process that we're talking about, because it's very detailed right now on how you might go through it, but it's also very complicated. So some of the amendments will attempt to try to change that, but there are a number of things that you have to go through, a number of hoops that you have to get through in order to get this, and hang on to it. So it's not just a simple sort of thing, but it does need to be less complicated for both the courts as well as the individuals.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for coming forward. Our first panel is going to be Trues, Neil, Brian, and Brian, I can't tell
Judd.
If it's Judd. Okay. Couldn't tell if it's two D's or not. And then I'm also going to ask Nova Sweet to please join them. I'm trying to fill up the three chairs at a time.
You couldn't have done better.
All right. So if you have not given testimony before, we need your name on the record, and then if you'll give us your testimony. If you filed written testimony, please don't read it verbatim. Just summarize it for us, and please proceed. Who'd like to go first?
I'll go first. Chair Brzezinski and Vice Chair Thatcher. My name is Trues Neal. I am the Deputy Director of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, also a member of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and also I was a member of the task force with Senator Dimbrough and Senator Frederick. And I'm here to support Senate Bill 690, that the Certificate of Good Standing. We did submit a letter of support, so I won't read that. But I will say that in our state, in our work in community corrections, we pay attention to recidivism. It's one of our key benchmarks. It's that 30% to 40% that we're looking at. And those are the people we need to track, follow, make sure they're getting in line, and address their behaviors and try to correct them. But then there's another percentage, about 60 to 70% that are doing the right thing. They're engaging in programs, they're getting employment, they're trying to get housing, they're trying to parent their children, and they're trying to get on the right track. Those are the people that we want to have a way to separate them from the rest of those 30 or 40% that don't do the right thing. We want them to have an opportunity with landlords and employers to show, hey, I've done something different. I've made a difference in my life. Next to me is Brian Judd, who works for Mercy Corps Northwest. He's been engaged in being a mentor. He's been engaged in helping us with justice-involved individuals for about 6 or 7 years. Brian is also a graduate of a reentry program in Multnomah County. Brian is not able to work for Multnomah County because of some of the CJIS rules that we're not dealing with here, but I would trust Brian to be an employee of Multnomah County. I would trust Brian to be my neighbor. But those are the kinds of people that I think need to have something that says, I'm different. I have done what I needed to do to make amends for the wrongs I've done in the past, and I want to have a different life. So I'm going to turn it over to Brian from here and the other person and let them speak.
Thank you. Brian?
Thank you, Trolls. Chair Przanski, co-chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Judd. I am the program manager for Mercy Corps Northwest Reentry Transition Center. The idea behind this bill was we had always taught rent well. I took rent well. It was a great program, taught you tenant responsibilities, rights, how to ask for letters of accommodation when appropriate, how to secure housing. It comes with a rent guarantee landlords can access. Great program. A lot of agencies teach it. Not a lot of landlords accept it or know about it. You know, what I would encourage with part of this bill that I support, 690, should it move forward, would be the public service awareness campaign, letting people know exactly what this entails once the details are worked out so people understand what the state is certifying by issuing this certificate. We've got a consortium of previous Department of Community Justice professionals, landlords, a tenant advisory council member, property managers, and some members of the recovery community in our community-based model that would review criteria that will be spoken to in the details and amendments to this bill, stating what the criteria are. And this is truly, like Trull suggested, the people that have entered the Department of Corrections and then got their time in community corrections and have corrected their behavior. The people that are willing to even apply for this are pretty proactive, people that want to provide a safe home for their children, people that want to get a decent job so they can afford to provide for their family. In issuing those, we've gotten Home Forward interested in accepting at two properties in Portland. They're single residencies. They're not for families yet. So with authentication from the state behind this would truly give people who meet criteria, who have been proactive, who have successfully done the corrective actions to remediate their past, have an opportunity to have it in the database where they go to do a background check, state that they have done this. The length of time for an expungement, I'm 9.5 years in towards my expungement, and like Trull said, I've been offered 3 jobs in the past year that I applied for, qualified for, went to the panel interviews, was selected and offered the job, and then disqualified because of my record from 9.5 years ago. It's easier to repair your credit than it is to get people to give you a chance at rent. I pre-qualified to buy a home rather than try and rent with my criminal record still going to be part of that consideration. I think everybody's spoken really well to a lot of it. The task force did a great job reviewing this and strengthening what was previously introduced by Justice Demunis. And I'm going to let Nova speak, and thank you for your time today. I'd be happy to answer any questions related to our community-based model, if possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Nova?
Hi, my name is Nova Sweet, members of the committee. I'm just a regular person from Benton County, and I happen to be a fly on the wall a lot of the reentry task force meetings for another mission of mine. But heard about the certificates of good standing, and my eyes lit up. I got really excited and full of emotion because it's something that I feel like is a way that I can potentially earn and prove to my community that I had a brief moment in my life that I screwed up and that I want to make it right. I'm an Oregonian through and through. I graduated high school out of Corvallis High School. I earned a full ride Division I basketball scholarship to the University of Louisville and played there for all 4 years from 90 to 94. I went on to get my bachelor's in criminal justice, and then I coached there for 2 years and got my master's in criminal justice. I was a law-abiding, mostly, tax-paying citizen. I had a child after living in Kentucky for almost 11 years. I came back to Oregon, became a professional in the mental health field, working in child and family therapy, loved it, decided to go back to school and got my master's in social work from Portland State. Continued to work, had another child in my mid-30s, and downfall. So that's where a lot of bad choices started happening for me. In 2011, I ended up having to go to prison for 3 years for a lot of those choices. I'm back out. I've been out for just over 2 years. I'm still on parole. And I'm slowly clearing up the wreckage of my past. I am desperate to find a way. Any certificates matter to me. Clearly, I've graduated college a bunch of times. I think these things are important. And myself and Brian, and I think anybody else who is trying to like prove that we've changed, we'd work for this. There wouldn't be any bamboozling, or potentially there'd be somebody trying to forge something, but I just don't think that people who are trying to do the right thing are going to worry about that kind of stuff. We're going to do the next right thing, and we're going to take whatever classes, we're going to pay whatever fees, we're going to show up to whatever meeting, we're going to do that because we want to prove and we want to be a part of all of you. And so I just want you to know that this, I don't know all the legwork that you guys have to do, but from a person who could really benefit from this, this is huge. This is like a college diploma in a lot of ways for me. And I just really urge you guys to take a look at this and support Senate Bill 690. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much. Our next panel is going to include Kimberly McCall, Connie Fletcher, and Oza Rothstein, I believe. I probably didn't get the first name. I think it's O-H-S. Hosea? Okay, sorry.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon, and I'm actually not going to make comments to you today. I came up as support and to ask questions. I have my intern with me here, and I'm going to let her take it from here.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Corinne Fletcher, and I'm here to say that the ACLU of Oregon supports Senate Bill 690 because it will remove barriers to housing and employment that will reduce recidivism and make our communities safer and fairer. Felony convictions stigmatize people long after they have rehabilitated and served their sentences, and most especially upon immediate release. Two of the biggest collateral consequences of incarceration are housing and employment, being denied housing and employment. And Senate Bill 690 will remove barriers to successful reentry. It will remove those barriers to housing and employment by providing housing providers and employers with a verified information about an applicant's good standing, which will allow people with past criminal records to more easily access these critical resources. Senate Bill 690 will also promote public safety. Research shows that people with criminal records are less likely to reoffend if they have a house and a job. And reducing recidivism means saving taxpayer money. And most importantly, Senate Bill 690 will strengthen fairness. After a person has completed their sentence and demonstrated they have rehabilitated, they shouldn't continue to be punished by being denied access to housing and employment. That actually increases the likelihood that they will reoffend. And so Senate Bill 690 will establish a process to recognize the hard work that people put into rehabilitating and support those individuals in their continued work as contributing members of their communities. So we urge you to join us in supporting Senate Bill 690.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Hosea Rothstein, and I'm going to share with you a little bit of my story. Like many women in my shoes, my story began with childhood sexual abuse. Despite their best efforts, my family couldn't help me. They didn't know what was wrong, and I didn't have the words to tell them. As a teenager, I turned to drugs as a way to cope with the pain I felt in my mind and my body. Instead, I ended up with additional pain and a felony conviction. Addiction closes doors to the opportunities young people are promised in society. When I stopped using drugs in 2012, I believed that the doors would be reopened. What I found is that doors don't open unless I have the right key, turn the handle, and push. Over the past 5 years, I've graduated with a Bachelor's of Science in Psychology and earned a 4.0 grade point average. I've completed a year-long internship, including mentoring struggling students and teaching undergraduate psychology courses. I've completed over 4,000 hours of voluntary community service. I've worked for the same local business for almost 5 years. Reading has been invaluable to my recovery, so I started a project to bring libraries to local inpatient residential treatment centers. I am currently halfway through my master's degree in mental health counseling and addiction specialization. I have been awarded 3 graduate assistantships and have been able to use those to open the doors to a new clinic serving the Portland area. Today, I am present in my life. I live with integrity and am able to give and receive love and respect in my relationships. I have been privileged to have the option of a life far removed from substance abuse and crime. My accomplishments have been earned through hard work and the support of others. Yet even with all of the accomplishments and the support, there are doors closed to me. I have struggled to find and have been denied housing. I have been turned away from volunteer positions seeking to help adolescents facing the same struggles that I have. I was told recently by counseling internships that they would love to hire me, but their hands were tied. I was arrested when I was 19 and convicted at 21. I am currently 26. This means that by the time that I am up for expungement at 31, I will have spent nearly a third of my life and all but 1 year of my adulthood, a period of time that will set the course for the rest of my life, carrying the stigma and the restrictions of a felony. Despite all the doors that I have opened, through my best efforts and with the support of others, I'm locked behind the doors of a felony conviction. This bill would unlock that door for me and for many others who have worked so hard to change their lives and become meaningful and valuable members of our Oregon community. Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for being willing to come forward before the committee and telling your personal story. It means a lot to us and gives us a focus. Questions? Ladies, thank you very much. All right, my last panel for Senate Bill 690 include Larry Bennett, Mary Sell. Was there anyone else who did not sign up for 690 that feel that they need to or want to give testimony? Mary, I'm going to let you go first since Larry is neutral. We'll probably be giving a perspective from the state.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. You've already heard from the most important people in the room today. Ms. Sweet, who I've had the opportunity to listen to multiple times in different venues, and I'm always impressed by, and then the young woman that just spoke to you, and then the gentleman that spoke earlier. These are the people who have the stories. Over the past 5 years, prior to coming to work in the building with you, I practiced as an indigent defense provider. I worked at a public defender's office, and I also worked at private firms offering indigent defense to adults, juveniles, and also practiced dependency law. During my 5 years of practice, I met people just like the people that you heard from today. Hundreds of people who are motivated, who care very much about being able to reintegrate into their community, people who are incredibly intelligent, passionate, and yet every day deal with roadblocks. OCDLA is very much in support of this bill. Thank you so much to the sponsors for bringing this forward. We believe that this is going to truly essentially be a game changer for a lot of people who are going to be able to, within a year after they finish their sentence or finish their probation successfully, be able to walk around and have some kind of proof that that the state believes in them again. And so we support it. We thank you. I think the one additional main point that we want to point out is a lot of times people are not eligible for expungement for a significant period of time. having something in the interim that is going to allow them to point to and say, yes, we're trustworthy, yes, we've done all the things that we're supposed to do, is going to be huge. And so thank you so much, and we're in support.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Bennett. I'm the Community Corrections Administrator with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 690. The department is, of course, well aware of many of the challenges that releasing offenders face when attempting to transition back into the community, all of which have been mentioned, or many of which have been mentioned, the difficulty with housing and finding employment, and just overall navigating the stigma associated with having been convicted of a felony. And the Department of Corrections is generally supportive of any efforts that work to mitigate those challenges for offenders. Senate Bill 690 will likely help address some of the many barriers offenders are faced with. And DOC is appreciative of a process by which a person who has successfully completed supervision is recognized for their achievement in an effective and efficient manner. Thank you.
Thank you for your concise testimony. Mm-hmm. All right, any questions for the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 690. We're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 101, and I'm not sure which council has 101.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 101 prohibits school personnel from disclosing information related to child abuse investigations that is conducted on school grounds while the investigation is pending. Provides the Department of Human Services or a law enforcement agency conducting the investigation is not required to reveal information about the investigation to school personnel. Requires school personnel to notify investigator if student has a disabling condition, and applies the statute to private schools. Mr. Chair, there is a dash A3 amendment that adds an emergency clause. We do have a revenue. There is no revenue impact statement. We have not yet received a fiscal impact statement.
So I have, I'm going to call out the first group, is Katie Suver, I believe, Stacy Ayers, and the last name for this one, I hope it's close to Amanda Duvall.
Amanda Duvall.
Sorry, Senator. Dalton.
Well, I mean, if you need to print better than this, because you see Dalton there? Like I said,
he's a doctor. We need a computer.
Need something. I know I need something. All right. Sorry for the butchering of the names. Hopefully, we got everyone to the table. Whoever would like to start off.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk today. My name is Stacy Ayers. I manage the Child Protective Services Program for the Department of Human Services at DHS. Department of Human Services at DHS. We're officially neutral on this bill, but it is a concept that I put forward, and this is relating to problems that the department has had really as a result of an appellate court case called Green versus Camerata. You may be familiar with it, that went up to the Supreme Court and was vacated. And since that time, schools in different parts of the state have, for varying reasons, have essentially blocked access to the department's ability to interview children at school safely away from their potential or alleged perpetrator. And at times have threatened to notify the alleged perpetrator and have prevented workers from conducting what is a legislatively mandated responsibility to interview children and make sure that they're safe. And the emergency clause, I would just say that it was added because, in large part, this is happening right now as we speak, schools preventing workers from interviewing children, and in some cases, very concerning allegations of abuse by their parents. And as recently as last night, I received an email from one of my program managers in a county local, or fairly local to the capital, indicating that they were a worker was blocked from actually being able to interview. So that was the impetus for putting the emergency clause, or asking for that to be put in. If it hadn't been put in before, I was going to ask that it be inserted today. There is no fiscal, and I believe that we had indicated that as of yesterday, but if not, I would just say for the record, we believe there will be no fiscal attached to this. This is not a fiscal type of bill. It simply allows workers to interview children when necessary without notifying parents first. And we have rules in place, and if a worker should have notified a parent and didn't, then we can address that as well. So with that, I'll go ahead and stop and turn it over to my other panelists here, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you, Stacy. Katie?
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Katie Suver. I'm with the on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County, have been so for a number of years, and among my duties are the prosecution of child abuse cases and assisting law enforcement by providing legal advice to them as they meander through and walk through criminal investigations, also at times advising DHS workers. What we have worked on through the bill itself, I guess in its original form, and then tried to work through with various amendments, is dealing with the real world issues that law enforcement and DHS workers are facing each day. And the intent of these amendments is to break down any barrier and to make it very clear to school officials that if law enforcement or DHS workers come into the school cannot hinder their access to the child. Many, many times when a report of abuse is received by DHS or law enforcement, there are many unknowns. And the only way to answer those unknowns or to hope to answer those unknowns is to be able to speak to the child. And this does not prevent or, I guess, affect any other rights that may apply if, you know, the child ultimately turns around and decides to tell their own parent about what happened, or law enforcement or DHS workers share this information at some later time. This bill does not affect their right and their ability to do that. What this bill does is, again, remove the barrier that school administrators sometimes believe they should enact or put up to have access to a child. And one of the things that the bill, I think, tried to make very clear is that it is the information itself that is obtained in a hearing, in a meeting with a child, an interview where a school administrator might be present, that the information that's obtained in that should not be then disclosed by the school administrator. Again, what we want to make clear is that law enforcement may end up disclosing that. DHS may, by their rules and protocol, end up disclosing that, but not the school administrator. Again, happy to answer any questions. I did speak with lobbyists for the Chiefs and Sheriffs Association. I do know that they are in support of this bill as well.
All right, thank you. Amanda.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton here on behalf of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, and we represent approximately 60 labor-based organizations representing your line officers across the state here today in support of Senate Bill 101. And we did work on this bill very closely with DHS and the DAs and Senator Gelsler down in the Senate Healthcare Committee. So this bill comes to you with several modifications. A couple I just want to highlight. As you've heard, these are important interviews for our officers. It's often the first opportunity to interview a child outside the presence of their parent if the parents are suspects. And so it's a very important step, a first step. They're not multiple interviews often happening. As you've heard, there is a form that these officers are being required to complete at the district today. And so we believe that any delay is a hindrance in that investigation. I want to also point out that first line of the bill where you see the word public deleted. This change will allow us access to all schools, so we think that that's an important change, and we urge your support of the bill.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you all for coming forward. Our next panel includes Gil Meyer and Laurie, is it Satin?
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair. We're working on it. We're working on it. I've been there.
I'm still here. remedial. What can I say? Self-imposed here. All right. Laura, you did not mark why you're here as a for, against, or neutral. So I know that Gail's here as neutral if amended. So I'm going to take a wild shot and say, Laura, go first.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Lori Satinsville for the Oregon School Boards Association. What's being passed out right to you today is our sample policies. OSBA has a policy department that takes laws and helps districts implement those through a sample policy procedures. And the form that Amanda mentioned previous is attached as well. There's a sample policy and then there's a district policy. Safety first. It's always safety, safety. And I'm struggling a little here with the school district tending to support any efforts to keep students safe. We know there's some challenges with interactions. Our administrators and staff are not attorneys. And in a case, I got a phone call regarding this bill 2 weeks ago from a superintendent. They said we've got a DHS investigator show up waving Senate Bill 101 around that said it passed. I don't have to sign your form. And it put people on edge as to what is going on. So I started working on this issue to figure out what's the problem. We want to be supportive. We've talked with DHS and with Senator Gelser to try to figure out how we can keep the student safe, keep the district safe. How do we move forward with that? These children are in our custody and we're trying to keep them safe. Maybe it's the form needs a different checklist. Do they have legal authority to be here? And that's what that form is about. A district has chosen to go into some more detail from the sample. We'd be happy to continue to work with DHS on a form that would work to help the school district know that the process they've followed keeps the district safe and that that person legally can be here. Be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are neutral on the bill as it relates to investigations occurring at schools as to victims or witnesses of child abuse. But and many of our practitioners practice dependency, and so they would be representing those victims of child abuse. We would feel better if the bill were more clear that none of this applies in the event of an investigation occurring at a school of the suspect of that abuse. Sometimes there's incestual sexual contact amongst siblings. It could be cousins, it could be next door neighbors, but sometimes the investigation of the abuse involves two students, one being the victim, one being the suspect. Of particular concern for us is the limitations on bill on lines 14 through 17, where there's an express legislative bar from school administrators or school members notifying any person other than the law enforcement agency or the department that the investigation is ongoing. There's a conversation going on over on the House side about juvenile interrogations, expressly juvenile interrogations of youth occurring in a school setting. Often a kid will say, "Can I please speak with my mom or dad?" And the conversation is unfolding. Some states require parents to be notified by school administrators when law enforcement is there to interrogate their child in a school setting. Some courts recognize that when a child says, "Can I speak with mom or dad," that actually is an invocation of their rights under Miranda, because what that kid is saying is, "I can't handle this one alone, so can I please have some adult in here with me?" So we would feel better if the bill were real clear that this is relating to investigations of victims or witnesses, and especially not suspects, because we wouldn't want a legislative directive here that the schools are barred from letting parents know that their child has been pulled out of the classroom and is being interrogated by the police in a school setting.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Manning?
Just real briefly, I think that, Mr. Chair, I think that that is a valid point. And from my personal experience, I've seen it happen to a grandson of mine where he was falsely accused of something and later went through all the processes and then found out that he had nothing to do with it.
All right. So where we're at on this, the chair is going to take an active part in this work group. That's whatever's happening. I see numerous little legal things. I want to make certain that we cross the T's and dot the I's to ensure we're going to get it right. I think the basis of the bill needs to move forward. I think we do need to make some certainties that we actually are going to do it appropriately and not have unintended consequences. Laurie, one question I do want to ask, or I can understand from a perspective of the school administrator having someone represent as they come in that they're with the Department of Human Services and they're there to do this investigation. Have you had any comment back from any of the school districts if it was a police officer, someone that's coming in either in uniform or that's a plain clothes that identifies themselves as a police officer? Have you had administrators trying to prohibit them from going forward? Because if they are, you might want to make certain they understand interfering with a police officer that they could, in fact, be charged with a crime.
Chair Brzezinski, I need to delve into this more, and from hearing that that's happening, the form actually says, you know, exactly what we do with the form. We can't identify information. The form doesn't go into personnel. As far as barring somebody, it could be because they wouldn't sign the form. I would have to ask more questions.
Yeah, we'll go through that in this little group. I understand where you could have somebody potentially, you know, that particular law doesn't apply to a DHS worker unless they also are a certified police officer or, in this case, probation officer has the same qualifications here. But we'll work through it, and I want to make certain that we do the best we can and ensure that someone who's representing them there for the purposes they say can, in fact, one, do their work, and two, be held accountable if they're doing something they're not supposed to be doing.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 101. And I said there's definitely work that needs to be done on that one. And we're going to open up our next public hearing, which is going to be on Senate Bill 327. And Whitney.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 327 extends recreational immunity to employees, agents, and volunteers of organizations providing recreational services while these persons are acting within the scope of their assigned duties. It also eliminates certain duties of care to maintain land. There is a Dash 1 amendment that removes the provision eliminating the duty of care. The Dash 1 amendment has a minimal revenue impact and an indeterminate fiscal impact.
All right, let me do this. Let me go ahead and get us started on 327. I have Ian Caldwell, Heath Curtis, and Rob Bobet. Sorry, gentlemen, who would like to start?
I guess I will, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Ovette, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. Here today, together with Heath, representing a coalition to restore recreational immunity. We have a one-pager as well as a list of all of the entities that are in support of Senate Bill 327. I'll be really brief. I know your time is really short. As you know, Oregon is just full of recreational opportunities on both private and public land. Some decades ago, a bargain was struck. And the bargain was this: if landowners allow their recreational lands to be used by the public for recreational purposes, we give those landowners immunity. It's called recreational immunity, and it's in state law. This opened up a lot of Oregon for a lot of opportunities for recreational use all across Oregon. All things were fine and dandy until we got to an Oregon Supreme Court case that was asked to interpret the recreational immunity statute. And what the Supreme Court said, in short, was that while the recreational immunity extended to landowners, it did not extend to the agents or employees of those landowners. virtually eviscerating recreational immunity. What this has resulted in as a practical matter is increased liability and significantly increased insurance costs to keep these recreational lands insured. Many parks and other recreational lands have been closed recently in Oregon as a direct result of that case. And looking at insurance rates and estimated rates for cities and counties around the state, there's going to be a whole lot more closures if we don't fix this gaping hole in the statute. So Section 1 of Senate Bill 327 fixes that issue, essentially puts us back to status quo ante, and restores the bargain that got struck some decades ago so we can avoid any further closures of recreational land in Oregon and reopen those lands that have been already closed. So we support Senate Bill 327. The Dash 1 amendments would confine the bill to just Section 1, which is just the surgical fix to the case that pointed out the flaw in the statute. With that, happy to answer any questions. I'll turn it over to Mr. Curtis.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. Because this is my first time this session appearing before you, I might mention OFIC is a trade association representing Oregon's large landowners. We have about 50 members. We represent most of Oregon's forest product manufacturers, and importantly, we own or control over 5 million acres of Oregon forest land. I'm also speaking on behalf of several other private landowning trade associations, and those are mentioned in the one-pager that's on the website, representing many millions of acres more and thousands of farms, all of which are strongly in support of Senate Bill 327. As Rob mentioned, my members' understanding of recreational immunity has been that it applied to employees and agents all the way since 1971, since that bargain was struck initially. The Supreme Court case on certified questions from the Ninth Circuit last year was a shock to my membership. On a personal note, for any of you who've been deer hunting on private timberlands in the fall, you know that there is extraordinary pressure, and there are a lot of costs associated with holding those lands open to the public. But one of the upsides to doing that is if you're willing to make those lands available for free, then you have immunity from liability that may occur if somebody gets hurt on those lands. That's a very, very important thing to landowners. And in the event that this were not fixed, that is to say the Senate Bill 327 were not to pass, the landowners would have a very difficult choice to make. I assure you that many would elect instead to close their lands and charge. So with that, we're in support of Senate Bill 327, and we've agreed that with the Dash 1 amendments, it's a bill we're behind. So please, we'd urge your yes vote.
Thank you.
Chair Plansky, members of the committee, I have submitted written testimony, and there's actually some photos in there of what I'm going to talk about today. My name is Ian Caldwell. I am a resident of Redmond in Central Oregon, and I'm an avid rock climber. I've been climbing for 25 years out at Smith Rock State Park. I do a lot of volunteer work. I volunteer to help take care of the trails at Smith Rock. I volunteer to help put in bolts for rock climbers, so when they fall, they're protected by bolts. I'm also a volunteer with Deschutes County Search and Rescue Program, and so when people get injured out at Smith Rock, I'm one of the first people on scene to help them out of there. Another recent project I did was working with the city of Redmond to construct a rock climbing route on the underside of a bridge. And so in 2007, the city built a 800-foot long bridge over the Dry Canyon, which is a city park. And that bridge had several arches. They're about 200 feet wide like this. The start of the arch is about 45 degrees overhang, goes to total vertical. Being a rock climber, I was like, wow, this is the coolest thing ever. It'd be so neat to climb on the underside of that. So I approached the city. We spent about a year and a half to write a management plan to specify what types of hardware we'd use. We did the highest standard we could in the climbing industry. We created a plan of how volunteers would sign up with the city, who would be allowed to put up routes and stuff. We based the model after every other single rock climbing place in America and in Europe and throughout the world. We have routes, we put bolts and protection in there, and people come up with their own personal rope and they climb that. I don't know of any lawsuits that anybody's ever filed against a landowner at any rock climbing area. In 2015, I spent about 100 hours in the middle of the summer, spent a lot of vacation time to go to the bridge. I drilled a lot of holes in the rock. I was starting to get tendonitis in my elbows. I was working so hard on that. We got it open. Me and the mayor of the Redmond, we cut the ribbon together. Had about 100 people show up. The news was there. Everybody's really excited. It made national magazines. People all over the world and the U.S. were really talking about this. After about 10 months being open, I got a call from the city of Redmond, and they told me that because of the lawsuit in Portland, that they were going to have to close the bridge because the insurance company no longer wanted to insure the bridge. So we had created it, and we worked with the insurance company, and they looked at it. They helped us write the standards for it, helped us write the language that we put on the signs there, and it was a nominal fee for the city of Redmond to be covered under that program. The city of Redmond shopped around for other insurance. It was going to cost $150,000 for a one-year insurance policy. And that was the only thing that they can find. Obviously, the city was not going to pay that amount for that. So the bridge has sat closed since July of 2016. Every day I go out to Smith Rock, climbers are asking me, when's the bridge going to be open? When's the bridge going to open? And I was like, well, we got to fix the law. I'm in strong support of this Senate Bill 327. The insurance company said, if you fix that law, then we'll reinsure your bridge again. So all it takes is a stroke of a pen, and we'll get up and going again. This is bigger than just this rock climbing bridge. We have rock climbing areas throughout throughout Oregon. Some of it's on federal land, some of it's on state land, some of it's on private timber company land. And for those landowners to be responsible for the climbing activity, they will not open up that land. And we will. This is just the first one that we saw close, and I'll assure you that we'll see more and more rock climbing areas closed. Rock climbing is huge in the U.S. and across the world. We have over close to 7 million climbers, you know, kids grow up in schools with rock climbing walls and stuff. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's going to impact climbing. It's going to impact mountain biking. It's going to impact hiking. It's going to impact a lot of outdoor recreation use. So, again, I encourage your support of Senate Bill 327.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Thatcher.
Maybe this question is for you, Mr. Chair. Maybe, Rob, you could address this. The amendment removes the provision eliminating duty of care to maintain land. Double negatives again. So I guess it adds back in the requirement to maintain land. I'm just trying to understand it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thatcher, so Section 2, and Heath can probably speak more to this than I can, was addressing kind of a side issue related to another case. And there is actually two other bills out there that also have additional sections that would arguably fix other issues. What we agreed to in our little work group that we had with Senator Przanski is we would not ask for more than just simply the surgical technical fix to correct what we call the Johnson problem that opened it all up. So Section 320, or Senate Bill 327, Section 1, is frankly all that is needed to just surgically fix that and nothing more. I can't promise you that we won't be back for more tune-ups to various other statutes to address tangential issues, but we have agreed to focus just surgically on fixing the problem created by the Supreme Court.
Okay, thank you. So this just restores it to the pre-Johnson decision, then, right?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. Today we have a couple of bills that kind of take it back to what was before a court decision came down. And I'll say this, on this particular case or situation, I think everyone assumed and believed that an employee or an agent or a volunteer for a nonprofit that has land was covered. But technically, when you read it, clearly it says land owner. And so only the owner of private or public land. And that's how the Johnson case basically came out, that they sued the employee of the city of Portland, and that's how it was interpreted, that they could do that.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, I think it's just important for the record to note that 105.696 specifically provides that this statute does not actually create a duty of care or a basis for liability. So there's no affirmative duties created by this statute. And with respect to the Horton case, which I know that this committee has heard about already this session, we think that this statute would survive analysis under that case as well. but an argument for another day.
Right. All right. Thank you very much. The gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. Very nice pictures and on the bridge. And we, even though we can't sign that document, hopefully the governor will put it to pin.
Thank you.
All right. The last two individuals I have scheduled are, let's say, wanting to testify on 327, Arthur Towers and Elizabeth Kushwa. While they're coming forward, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 327? Arthur, I'm going to let you go first.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm testifying solely on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association today. And I've testified before this committee a number of times, and you know that our members fight for and are passionate about safety, accountability, and justice. I really want to publicly thank Chair Przanski for forming a work group on this issue. We had an opportunity to sit down with stakeholders on this issue and hear a variety of different perspectives. Unfortunately, we couldn't agree on a lot of points, but we could agree on the idea that it's not preferable to hold the individual employee accountable when negligence hurts somebody who's involved in recreational activity. We couldn't agree on a lot more than that. We couldn't really agree on the consequences of this legislation, but we could agree on what's in the bill. You know, compromise is difficult. We don't always get everything that we want. I think that's what compromise means. Darn it. But that's where we are, and I wanted to put that on the record. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Elizabeth?
Good morning, Chair Przanski. Members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Kushwa with Children First for Oregon. And I have to say, this bill had me kind of stymied, because if my front stairs are broken and a child falls in a serious injury, I'm responsible. And if a child falls on the broken stairs of City Hall and is seriously injured, the city is responsible. But if a child falls on the broken stairs of a playground slide that hasn't been maintained, it's the kid's fault. And that bothers me. Accidents happen. This is not what that is, and, you know, from what I have seen. It seems to me that if the park or the playground hasn't been properly maintained, you know, that either, you know, the child, I shouldn't have to worry when my kid goes to the park, right? Or at this point, my grandkids. It seems to me that also that the parks and the playgrounds are different than the forest that the gentleman was talking about, right? There are man-made structures in parks and things that need to be maintained. I think that's different than a forest. So I think that there's probably, I don't know, apparently other compromises that could be achieved to protect the children who go to our parks and our playgrounds and play on the structures that are built there. And I think that we deserve to be assured that those are maintained properly. Accidents happen. This bill is about negligence, not accidents.
All right. Thank you. Questions?
I guess I do have a quick question. Do you agree or do you object to the notion that this does restore it to the pre-Johnson era, or does this open it up to other things beyond that?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, my understanding is it does restore it to the pre-Johnson situation, which...
Let me give the clarification. I think it takes us back to what we most people assumed was the interpretation pre-Johnson. It really came down to wordsmithing by the court, looking at how the statute was written, because it didn't state landowner or their agent or their employee. And but everyone, I think, over the decades felt that those individuals who were working in the capacity and the scope of their employer, or if they're a volunteer in a nonprofit landholding, that they would be covered under their umbrella of the term landowner. Thank you all very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 327. And what I'm going to go ahead and do is I'm going to go ahead and take the rest of the testimony on the other bills, because I just want to do that. Then we're going to come back and do work sessions all together, so people, please don't panic. All right. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 737. And I believe that is Josh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the introduced version of Senate Bill 737 clarifies reference to willful violation of the Service Members Civil Relief Act. There is, however, a dash one amendment that replaces the measure. The dash one amendment eliminates the damages cap on civil actions seeking damages for bodily injury and retains a $500,000 damages cap on civil actions seeking damages for wrongful death. The dash one amendment applies to actions in which the final judgment has not yet been entered and declares an emergency effective on passage. With the dash one amendment, Senate Bill 737 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. I have three people that are currently signed up for 737, Betsy Earls, Courtney Dresser, and Arthur Towers. Why don't the three of you come forward? While they're coming up, are there other individuals who wanted to give testimony on 737 with the dash ones, I believe is what the one that we're actually working under? All right, so Arthur, why don't you start, and then we'll pick up with Betsy and then Courtney.
Great. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, and on this bill I'm testifying both on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, but also on behalf of Restore Justice for Survivors, a 27-organization coalition comprised of advocates for seniors, advocates for people with disabilities, advocates for victims of sex abuse, child abuse, and elder abuse, as well as a couple labor organizations and civil rights organizations like the ACLU. So Senate Bill 737 is a compromised version of Senate Bill 487 that you heard a couple hours of testimony on about 5 weeks ago. My plan was to read the 2 hours worth of testimony from the Senate Bill 487 hearing, but I understand from the chair that would be a bad idea.
Very bad.
So,
very bad.
Perhaps a fatal idea. What's the difference between 487, the bill that you heard before?
You may want to watch it because I think Betsy Earls would yield her time to you if that would be the outcome.
Especially if it's fatal. Go ahead, Art.
I want to clarify that this bill no longer has to do with wrongful death. This is a compromise bill that simply reverts the law back to where we were from 1999 through May 2016, before the Supreme Court ruled that compensation caps in injury cases were allowable. Again, this bill now says that compensation for the severely injured, including, as you heard from the testimony before, people who are paralyzed, people who are dismembered, people who are disfigured, people who lose their sight, people who suffer the lifelong trauma of child abuse, elder abuse, sex abuse, those sorts of lifelong injuries would be able to be compensated based on what a jury feels is proper on a case-by-case basis. The bill previously indexed the wrongful death cap, compensation cap for inflation, and no longer does that. The bill addresses the retroactive impact of the Horton decision so that people who were injured prior to the May 5th, 2016 court ruling, but whose cases were on appeal or somewhere in the process, would not be subject to the cap. And with that, I think I will close, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. So, Betsy or Courtney, who'd like to go next?
I can go next, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. I'm appearing before you today in opposition to 737 and the Dash 1 amendments. Before I talk about 737, I wanted to give you a little bit of background on our opposition. In 1987, as you probably recall, the Oregon legislature passed the Tort Reform Act, which placed a statutory cap on non-economic damages. The intent of this act was to reasonably limit subjective and unpredictable non-economic damages while providing plaintiffs full recovery of any objective out-of-pocket and economic damages. 12 years later, in Lakin versus Senco Products, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that the Tort Reform Act's non-economic damages cap violated Article 1, Section 17 of the Oregon Constitution because it interfered with the right to have a jury determine the amount of damages. In Hugh versus Peace Health, the Supreme Court clarified that case, their ruling in that case, stating that that decision was limited only to causes of action that were recognized at common law when the Oregon Constitution was written in 1857. So fast forward to 2016, Horton versus Oregon Health and Sciences University, and the Supreme Court overruled Lakin, and they were concluding that the right to jury trial is actually a procedural matter, and the legislature can define substantive rights, including recoverable damages. The court said that a damage cap is not a legislative attempt to reweigh the jury's factual findings. Rather, it's a legal limit on the damages that applies generally in a class of cases. The court also noted that in 22 jurisdictions that have considered this issue, 17 of them have held that a damages cap does not violate either a state or federal constitutional right to a jury trial. Horton effectively reinstated the non-economic damages cap that was passed by the legislature in 1987. 737 with the proposed -1 amendments will limit the application of the non-economic damages cap to wrongful death actions. The proponents suggest that this returns the law to where it was before Horton was decided, but unfortunately, by design or inadvertently, Senate Bill 737 and the -1 amendments does quite a bit more than that. Lakin and Hughes only said that the cap could not be applied to causes of action that were recognized at common law in 1857. This means that prior to Horton, any common law action created after 1857 and all statutory causes of action would have been subject to the cap. So arguably, this could include claims such as wrongful death, survival actions, strict product liability, infliction of emotional distress, and other causes of action that might have been created by common law or statute even into the future. Because of that, we urge your opposition to Senate Bill 737 and the -1 amendments, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Courtney?
Good morning. Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and I'm here to put a few things on the record from the provider perspective. As you remember, when we did the hearing for the original bill, incoming President Dr. Kevin Rivas testified about some of the issues around access to care and our concerns about what increasing liability premiums could do. With Senate Bill 737 and the -1s, we still have those concerns. We are trying and looking for a predictable environment. Predictability allows for lower healthcare costs in general, and the -1 does not allow for that predictable environment around liability premiums. So we continue to have the same issues around how we continue to provide access for care for all of Oregonians, especially in rural Oregonians. As a provider community, we're facing much uncertainty, and so are our patients. ACA repeal, the implementation of MACRA, federal issues on federal budget cuts, uncertainty at the state level for providers regarding rate cuts, uncertainty on funding for programs that help recruit and retain providers in rural Oregon. All these items make it even more important for some predictability in the healthcare world. Right now we have that with predictable caps on both non-economic damages and injury cases and wrongful death, and we like to continue to see that happen. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So the first thing I'd like to do is just put onto the record, we've made reference to it, Senate Bill 487 was the bill that we had before this committee earlier this session. So by reference, I'm incorporating the testimony that was in 487 into the proceeding here, so we will have a record for those who might be doing history in the future, understanding that we did in fact take testimony under 487 that is truly applicable to 737, and instead of having all of those individuals need to come forward, we are basically bringing that testimony in as reference for the bill that's before us. So with that, other questions or comments? All right, I have a couple things I'd like to just go over. And Courtney, I guess this is first one's going to be for you on the predictability issue. Knowing that the Horton decision was just May of 2016, seems to me that if we're talking predictability, that's different from what it was pre-Horton decision. We're talking about less than a year. Is that correct?
Yes, and yes, Chair.
All right. And then prior to that, prior to the Horton decision, if I got this correct, for 17 years, we had what would be predictability under the terms of the statute prior to the ruling that caps were not unconstitutional as established in 1999 under the Lincoln decision, where they said that non-economic damages were a issue for a jury to decide under a right to a jury trial. Is that correct?
Chair, I think what has happened in the last 17 years is that we've had, as a state, this legislative body has had to several times provide funding to providers in certain parts of our state, and especially providers in high-risk specialties like OBGYN and cardiology and surgery, so they can afford their premiums and medical liability. So we've had a need for that because of the unpredictable nature of a non-capped environment. So I think what we would like to see is for one thing, a couple things. One, for what the law, the Supreme Court just did, to stay in place for a while and see how the courts figure this all out, because there's still many cases going through right now, is my understanding, and see how they continue to interpret the Horton decision, and two, that again would allow us opportunity to have a predictable environment and see what's going to happen.
Chair Brzezinski, just wanted to address one point that my colleague here made, that is that this decisions are already being rendered and the cap is being applied. Scott Bush was a gentleman who was crossing the street in a crosswalk with the light and was struck by a garbage truck making a wrong turn. His leg was severed on the spot in downtown Portland. The jury awarded him $10.5 million for non-economic compensation for non-economic loss, and the court has on January 27th reduced that to $500,000. So we're seeing how the process is working. One other thing I thought was important to get on the record is that the amended bill is also in keeping with the ballot measures, with the will of the voters in terms of ballot measures they defeated twice since 1999.
All right, Senator Thatcher.
I heard Betsy mention that, I'm wondering what you have to say to it, that the amendment for 737 does more than just restore it to pre-Horton conditions, and that it actually adds to lifting the caps not only on common law, this is my understanding, anyway, correct me if I'm wrong, to not only on common law issues but all statutory issues moving forward, which wasn't necessarily the case prior to Horton.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, I think that's subject to interpretation.
That's why we have judges.
I guess that's why we have courts and lawyers for both sides all the time.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the testimony and public hearing on 737. We're going to open up our last of our public hearings, which is on Senate Bill 896. And I'm not sure who has that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 896 modernizes the law related to appeals in criminal cases. And I would just note that there is a very detailed Oregon Law Commission report on all this for anyone who's interested in the details.
Yeah, which will not need to be read in the record since it's already part of the record. So we have three individuals, I believe, that are going to be coming forward. McKenzie, Judge Stephen Bouchon, I believe. And then is it John or Jan Nads? I can't read the print.
I'll get us started off. Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Mackenzie Zook. I'm a third-year law student at Willamette University College of Law, as well as an extern with the Oregon Law Commission. After graduation, I hope to practice in the area of cannabis business law, and while most of my prior legal experience has been focused on business law, externing with the Oregon Law Commission has provided me with valuable opportunity to gain firsthand exposure to the legislative process. As you may know, the Oregon Law Commission was created in 1997 for the purpose of conducting a continuous program of law revision, reform, and improvement. Through efforts to simplify, modernize, and consolidate existing statutory provisions, as well as propose new substantive and procedural statutory provisions, the Commission helps to ensure comprehensive and practical laws for Oregonians. Pursuant to these objectives, Appellate Commissioner Jim Nass requested via project proposal that the Commission convene a work group to overhaul the laws governing appeals in criminal cases. The Commission assembled the Direct Criminal Appeals Work Group, which is chaired by Judge Stephen Bichong and has a membership comprised of a representative cross-section of participants in the appellate court segment of the criminal justice system. Over the course of 24 meetings, lasting approximately 2.5 hours each, the members of the work group contributed their effort and expertise to produce Senate Bill 896, which addresses portions of the Oregon revised statutes pertaining to appeals in criminal cases. To tell you more about Senate Bill 896, I'm going to turn it over to Judge Stephen Bichong.
Morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Steve Bichong. I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County. I've been a judge since 2008. I'm also a member of the Oregon Law Commission and served as the chair of this work group that created this bill. I'm going to do a couple things very briefly. I'm going to describe the problem that we were attempting to address, summarize briefly the process that we engaged in to address the problem, and then give you just an overview of what this bill does to solve the problem, and then I'll turn it over to Appellate Commissioner Nass. So first, the problem. The statutes that address criminal appeals, an appeal of a decision in a criminal case, have been adopted and amended over the course of many, many years. And we found in going over these statutes that some of them dated back to the DD Code, which was prior to statehood and compiled in 1864. There's, as you can imagine, when statutes are adopted in this sort of piecemeal fashion, through no fault of anybody, there are gaps and there's overlap and inconsistencies and areas that call upon the courts to interpret. And there's never been a comprehensive overview of these statutes until now. Because of the way the statutes evolved over time, there were two big problems that we were trying to address. First, the statutes were really unclear as to when the appellate court would have jurisdiction. You know, when a trial judge's decision would be appealable, that gives rise to an appellate court jurisdiction. So appealability and jurisdiction kind of go hand in hand. And then the statutes were unclear on that, and they were also unclear as to what would be reviewable on appeal. So even if the appellate court had jurisdiction, it may not have the authority to address the question that one of the parties wanted to raise. And as a result of this unclarity, lawyers being lawyers, that out of an abundance of caution, they're going to raise every issue they can, challenge the jurisdiction of the court, challenge whether the court has authority to review the question that the parties wanted the court to address. And this resulted in litigation where really public resources, you know, the main players in this are all publicly funded entities, Department of Justice, the Office of Public Defense Services, and the courts. And we're spending all those resources not addressing the merits of the appeal, but addressing whether we could or should address the merits of the appeal. And so that seemed to be a waste. The second main problem was that the lawyers and the litigants, self-represented parties, and the courts had no easy, clear way to understand and navigate the system for criminal appeals. So many issues required legal interpretations by the courts. And so if you were trying to figure out, well, can I appeal this issue, or will the court address this issue if I raise it on appeal, you'd look to the statute, you couldn't find the answer, you'd have to do a lot of legal research. And this was very expensive, costly, time-consuming, and frankly unnecessary. So that's what led Commissioner Nass, who's kind of at the front line of addressing these jurisdictional issues, to come to the Law Commission and say, we ought to take a look at this and try to fix this. So the Law Commission appointed a work group of basically all the participants in this process. The participants are listed in your report at pages 2 and 3. You can look at that if you'd like to. They asked me to chair it. As a trial court judge, I'm not a direct participant in the appellate process. It's my decisions, and all my colleagues who are trial judges, our decisions get appealed, but we don't, then the ball's out of our hands once it goes up on appeal. I did have an interest in making the system work better, so I agreed to chair this work group. And as Mackenzie noted, we met 24 times over the course of a year, which, you know, that averages out to twice a month, to get this group of judges and lawyers all together. And initially we started meeting monthly. We realized we could never get it done if we met that infrequently, so we upped it to twice a month. And then as the legislative session got nearer, we decided to meet like weekly so we could get this done and get the bill to you. So the first thing we did when we met is we just read the statutes, Chapter 138, kind of discussed, well, what are the holes, what are the problems, what is it that we really need to do? Because if we could have just adopted some short fixes, we would have at least proposed that. And we quickly realized that, no, this was a bigger problem. We had to address a comprehensive reorganization, rewrite of these statutes so that it made sense. We tried to codify where we could, establish case law so that litigants and participants in the system wouldn't have to do a lot of legal research. They could just look at the statute and find the answer. And so that was kind of the first step. Next, what we did is we kind of made an outline. We actually put it up on the board of an organizational structure that we as a group thought would make sense, because the current statute, there was no real organizational structure to it. That structure really is the basis for the bill. As you'll see, it's organized on page 5. It's got sort of the organizational structure of the bill. Once we did that, we then took what we weren't trying to reinvent the wheel. What there were a number of existing statutes that were working just fine that addressed the problems clearly, and so we would figure out where they fit within our organizational structure, and we pieced it all together and tried to. And that became our working draft number one of this bill in the work group. We eventually went through, I think, 14 or 15 drafts before we got to the end. But that was kind of the start of the substantive work, where we started addressing in detail within the work group each section, and we identified areas that required additional research. There's a number of research memos that are included in the record. They're listed in the appendix on page 29 of our report. And then we ultimately got to the point where we wanted to agree on, we got the work group to agree on a bill, agree on the wording. And as you can imagine, with this many appellate lawyers and judges all together, there was a lot of wordsmithing that went on in coming up. There were areas that required some compromise, give and take on both sides. We achieved consensus within the work group, which is no small feat when we had representatives from the state, the District Attorneys Association, from the on the defense side, the Oregon, the Office of Public Defense Services. We had lawyers in private practice who were defense lawyers, and we had representatives of the courts, because we wanted to make sure that this would work for the courts. And then the last task was to prepare this lengthy report that you've all have. And we did that not to burden you folks, but basically with the hope that if this comprehensive piece of legislation is enacted, that we would have a kind of a roadmap for the practitioners who utilize this system to have a resource where they could understand because lawyers being lawyers, anytime you change a word or two in a statute, they think, oh, that there's some significance or what's the meaning of that change. So we wanted to explain in some detail what we did and why, so that it was clear and understandable. So the solution, there were two areas that we kind of punted on. One is that there are, in some cases, there are appeals in what's known as special statutory procedures that might be related to a criminal case. We would have liked to address that, but we frankly ran out of time, so we're going back to the Law Commission suggesting that this work group continue, and probably we'll be back next session with the kind of the final piece of this bill. And then the second area that we punted on, appeals in criminal cases can also come from justice and municipal courts. And we didn't have representatives on the work groups from the people involved in that process. So we wanted to set that aside and let the interested parties in those groups address that. So the solution that we came up with is Senate Bill 896. The organizational structure is as described in the report. I guess I'm not going to go through it in any detail because I know your time is limited here, but I think the biggest concepts for you to understand and that we wrestled with was the idea of what's appealable and what's reviewable. And those are two distinct concepts, because what's appealable depends on, you know, who's got jurisdiction. From my perspective as a trial judge, I don't want jurisdiction taken away from me until I'm done with the case. If I'm done ruling on it, and I've done everything I'm going to do, then, okay, someone who doesn't like my ruling can take it up on appeal. That's fine. But if I'm still working on it, I don't want jurisdiction taken away from me. So the existing statutes hadn't really clearly defined in a comprehensive way, hadn't defined at all the concept of appealability. So we've put in a definition of what that is. And we also we made a judgment in crafting this bill to make it easier for practitioners. We wanted to kind of separate out when we're talking about an appeal by a defendant and an appeal by the state, because those are two different areas. And we wanted it to be easy. If one side or the other, if you know which side you're on, which they always do, they know where to look in the bill and where to look in the statute. So we broke that out. There is in this bill a little bit of overlap, because both on the concept of appealability and on the concept of reviewability, what the court has authority to review on appeal, it's often the same, or there may be parallel provisions. And we debated on trying to put everything that was parallel together so we didn't have to repeat it, but then that would defeat the purpose of having a clear roadmap for those who are appealing from one side or the other. So we broke those out and separated those. So that's essentially what the bill does. I could walk you through it in more detail if you want me to, but I don't think you want me to.
I hate to do this because you are a judge, and I don't want to be held in contempt, even though I have.
I don't have any authority here, Chair President.
But if you could wrap up, because we do need to hear from Jim, and I have work sessions I need to do.
I am at my conclusion.
All right.
My conclusion is one thing is what this bill does not do. It does not resolve any substantive issues relating to criminal law. What would be a violation? What would be the penalty for that violation? Doesn't do any of that. This is a good bill. This is a good government bill. It's not a sexy bill. It's not going to get a lot of headlines, but it does make government work a lot better. So it's something that we're proud of, and you could be proud of when you move this bill, and hopefully when it gets approved by the legislature. With that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Nass.
Thank you. Jim.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Nass. Currently serve as the appellate commissioner for the Oregon Court of Appeals. I've worked for the appellate courts in various roles for about 30 years. Whichever role I was serving at any given time included screening appeals for jurisdiction. And things bubbled along for many years just fine. In 2011, the Supreme Court decided a case called State versus, I think it's Cloutier, C-L-O-U-T-I-E-R, that interpreted a statute that was adopted as part of the sentencing guidelines statute in 1989. And it kind of brought to the surface that there were actually a lot of issues about what can you appeal and what can you get review of. In fairly quick succession, the appellate court spent an inordinate amount of time wrestling with what can you appeal and what can you get review of. And indeed, I and the staff I work with ended up spending an inordinate amount of time deciding these issues. To me, this didn't make sense. Employees of the court, tax support institution, district attorney's office, Department of Justice, tax support institutions, Office of Public Defense Service, the same way. We're all wrestling with these issues and spending a lot of time on them, and it made sense to me that we ought to simplify the rules, that the rules ought to be clear for almost any citizen to be able to open up the ORS, read what the rules are, so at least they know what you're getting into. For most people, this would be truly dreary stuff. For me, I'm like a kid in a candy store because this is in my wheelhouse, and I'm very happy. As the judge referred to, for instance, Section 3 of the bill says, defendant can appeal from these decisions and list them. Section 4 says the state can appeal from these decisions, list them. Section 13 of the bill says, court can review these issues on behalf of a defendant. Section 14 says the court can review these issues on behalf of the state. If this bill does nothing else, simply making those rules clear for any citizen or any practitioner or any judge to look at, review, and consider, I think is huge. And as the judge referred to, over the years, the courts have published decisions that bear on appealability and what can be reviewed. It occurred to me that we ought to codify those so that people interested in those issues don't have to go do legal research. They simply open up the ORS and they will find the answers there. I could talk a lot more about the details of the bill, but I think I will spare you that, and if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you for taking us in consideration. I know I will be looking at the report of 106 pages because I probably will be the one carrying the bill. So with that, are there questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 896. My understanding is that we're waiting for paperwork on 896, and there's no amendments for that bill. It just needs the paperwork needs to get here, so we'll make certain we have that teed up when we get the paperwork. With that, we're going to go into our work sessions. I'm going to start with the work session on Senate Bill 327, and we have a -1 amendment, I believe, that we need to incorporate in the 327.
Okay, Chair Brzezinski, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 327.
Senator Thatcher moves -1 into Senate Bill 327. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 327 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 327 as amended by the -1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry 327 to the floor. We'll close the work session on 327. We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 737. And we need a -1 for 737. Senator Thatcher, are you going to make the motion?
Mr. Chair, I move -1 amendment to Senate Bill 737.
Senator Thatcher moves the -1 amendment in Senate Bill 737. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I will move Senate Bill 737 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 737 as amended by the Dash Ones to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the improvement over the original 487, and I do appreciate the attempt to move it back to Free Horton. I don't think this gets as surgically there as we are with the previous bill that we were trying to restore to, you know, a court decision, the pre-Johnson decision. So I would prefer to see it more surgically done, if we can say that. So I don't support this particular motion, but will be I am working on an amendment that I believe will try to address that more surgically.
All right. Thank you very much. Other comments? Senator Lithicum.
I also think this is overreach, and we ought to constrain it if we're trying to solve distinct problems. And if, since you have two objections here, we'll try to get the amendment in, or I wouldn't mind filing a minority report, but we'll see how that goes as we move along.
All right. Thank you. Other comments or discussions? We have a motion before us to move the bill 737 with the Dash Ones to the floor. I sense that we have two objections, so I think for the record on this one, let's go ahead and do a voice vote on this one.
Senator Denbrough?
Aye.
Senator Lincecum?
No.
Senator Manning?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Przanski?
Aye. Motion carries, and Chair will be carrying the 737 as amended to the floor. We'll close the work session on 737. We're going to go ahead and open up our next work session, which is on Senate Bill 64. And I believe that is Joshua's. If you can bring us up to speed on that one, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 64 replaces the measure. It substitutes the phrase qualifying mental disorder for the current phrase mental disease or defect. The amendment includes a preamble describing the legislative intent behind this change. With the Dash 4 amendment, Senate Bill 64 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right. So we need a motion on the Dash 4s for Senate Bill 64.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 4s of Senate Bill 64.
Senator Thatcher moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 64. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 64 as amended to the floor with the do pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 64 as amended by the Dash 4s to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Again, discussion?
Mr. Chair, I do have some remaining questions. I am going to be a no for now.
All right. Any other comments?
I also disagree with the focus of this.
All right. With that, is there any other discussion? Lisa, I think I'd like to have a voice vote on this one as well.
Senator Denbrough.
Aye.
Senator Lincecum.
No.
Senator Manning.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher.
No.
Chair Przanski.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair will carry the Senate Bill 64 as amended to the floor, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 64, and we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 689.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 689 was brought to us by Senator Denbrough. We first heard this bill on March 14th. We had the Dash 1 amendment at that time, and we now have the Dash 2. Senate Bill 689 reestablishes the Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. The Dash 2 would increase the length of the task force size to 20 members. There is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right, so we need the Dash 2s for Senate Bill 689.
Okay, Chair Przanski, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 689.
Senator Thatcher moves the Dash 2 amendments into for Senate Bill 689. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 689 to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and what's the subsequent? What's the word?
Yeah.
Oh, that, okay. Where is it? No, not the bill. Be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. That's the part I was looking for.
Thank you very much. So Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 689 as amended by the Dash Twos to the floor with the due pass recommendation and along with the prior reference of a referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Since that one will be going to Ways and Means, we will not establish a carrier at this time. Senator Dimbrough, I would assume that you would be willing to carry it if it makes it out of Ways and Means or one of the other primary.
When it makes it out of Ways
when
and
it makes
Means,
it out. All right, when it makes it out, excuse me. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 689. Colleagues, I do want to give you notice regarding scheduling. Next week, Friday, the 14th, we are going to be setting up a time to have a meeting that will start, I believe, at 10:30. I know that Senator Manning has obligations with Ways and Means. I'm sorry. All right. So we're scheduled to have a meeting on the 14th from 10:30 to 1 with the understanding that we may need to come back for a 3 to 5 slot. The purpose of the schedule for that day is primarily to do work sessions. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't take in new public hearings, but at this point, that's what we're looking at because we're looking at our schedule. Knowing that we have to have stuff completed out of the committee by the 18th, that we felt that that was a day that we could clear a lot of the work session work that we will need to do.
Are you aware that's a Good Friday day?
I was not aware of that. I have talked to the president's office, and they say that that is a day that they will be scheduling. We are not, I think, as the legislature scheduled to take that day off. So the goal would be to do as quick as we can the work that we need to do. I'm giving you the notice because I just want to try to give you a heads up as to what is in the process. We may have to readjust and reevaluate, but that's kind of the plan at this point. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close for the day. Thank you all very much for everything. Everyone have a good weekend since we will not be meeting tomorrow, and we'll be back here on Monday at 8 a.m. Too late to schedule. At 8 a.m. Too late to schedule.